Saunders, reel number 8. You were explaining to me that the Lewis gun was at the beginning not always an entirely efficient weapon.
Well, it was a very efficient weapon, really, but of course, through our ignorance, it lost a lot of that efficiency. For instance, in the first place, we didn't get any instructions on it at all, no written instructions with it, and nobody knew anything about it because at that time there weren't any what were called armourers in the Flying Corps. And first of all, we were told that these drums carried 50 rounds of ammunition. Well, we put 50 rounds in, but we found that they were continually getting stuck for about until the first half dozen gone. Then we decided that we'd only put 47 in. Well, with the 47 in, they were quite efficient, except for dud ammunition. Then we got a stoppage. Another thing was that after being out, say, on a dawn patrol, you went to use your Lewis gun, you found you couldn't. And then the order came out. Well, it wasn't really an order, it was just the general information handed round from one to the other, that if you fired three or four rounds every, say, quarter of an hour, half hour, that they didn't stick. But even then, we didn't understand why. And it was only more by chance than anything else that we found out what it was. And that happened to be by accident, because one of the riggers who was responsible for the gun happened to send it up in an aircraft without oiling it before he went. And the result was he didn't get any trouble with it. That started us thinking. So instead of putting plenty of oil on the working parts, as we thought should be all right, we found that this oil was freezing up. But there was no indication of that when we landed, because by that time it had thawed out. Another thing we had a lot of trouble with was we got a lot of American ammunition. And we had a fearful lot of trouble with that, with the result that we dumped thousands and thousands of rounds in it, buried it in the airdrome, out of the way, wouldn't use it. Then somebody had a brainwave that somebody should be an armourer. So there was a chap named Warner, Billy Warner.
This was a decision taken within the squadron, was
Within
it?
the squadron, just amongst ourselves, but of course the officer in charge, he decided that we'd have an armourer. So we put Billy Warner in charge of this little hut called the armoury, and his job was to clean the guns every time they came down. And on a bench, he had a vise in which he had a barrel of a gun clamped, and before he started loading up any drums, every round that he put into the drum, he had to try in this barrel to see there was an easy fit in this barrel he had attached to the vise. And in that way, we didn't get any stoppages from ammunition faulty. So
How long was it, in fact, before you decided that an armourer was a necessary addition to the personnel of the squadron?
well, it was must we've been using the guns, I suppose, for about 6 weeks or so. But then this armourer, I must point out, he had no training as an armourer. He was just an ordinary mechanic, and he just got into the way of handling these guns, studied them, and he was the armourer up the time I left. He was recognised as an armourer then.
Were there any other interesting developments in armament during this period?
Yes, we had a Flight Sergeant Fitzgerald with us, who was absolutely mad on guns and how they were manufactured and one thing and another. And he was a very good mechanic, and he devised a scheme whereby you could put a Lewis gun on the top plane of our Morand machines. And our Morand machines lent themselves to this very much, because it was a high-wing monoplane, and in order to anchor these wings to the fuselage, there was part of the framework went over the pilot's head, and that was part of the fuselage, definitely, and then the wings were anchored to this. Well, Sergeant Fitzgerald found out that he could anchored, put a Lewis gun on the top there by stripping off some of the fabric and making this arrangement, this fitting for the gun, on the top of the plane. This frame, part of the frame on top of the fuselage to which the wings were anchored was called the caban. I'm not quite sure how you spell it, but C-A-B-A-N-E, I think. When this gun was fitted up in this position, it fired straight ahead, but just cleared the propeller tip as it was revolving. Well, the gun was also mounted in such a way that when the ammunition was exhausted, the observer could reach up his hand and lower the gun and put on a new drum of ammunition and reset it, and then the pilot could use that drum.
From the pilot's point of view, what exactly was the advantage that this new kind of gun fitting gave him?
Well, he was able to aim the aircraft at the enemy. If he put the aircraft straight at the enemy, then the gun fired straight ahead, whereas previously he had to fly at an angle and fire at about an angle of 60 degrees to his line of flight.
As far as you can remember, was this an original invention for Number 1 Squadron, or was it an idea which was copied from some other squadron?
No, this was originally thought of by Flight Sergeant Fitzgerald of Number 1 Squadron, but of course it didn't adapt itself to any other kind of aircraft, just peculiar to this aircraft. But afterwards, of course, there were other mountings devised which gave the same range of fire.
Now, after this development whereby the machine gun was moved from its fixed position on the left-hand side of the pilot, when it was moved onto the top of the plane in the way you've just explained, did this change actually affect the techniques which you employed in aerial combat?
Well, not exactly the techniques in such a word, but supposing now you were attacking from behind, from the top, and you had the sun behind you with the old fixing, well then there was quite a possibility, in order to get your gun to bear on the aircraft, you had to move out of the sun, because that would have fired at an angle to the aircraft you were flying. Whereas,
so you had to approach from above, but to one side.
If you had the old technique.
Yes, I see.
But if you had the gun firing from the top position, the top of the plane, well then you could more than likely keep the sun directly behind you and come straight down at him and aim your aircraft at the other aircraft, because your gun was fixed on your top plane and fired straight ahead of you.
Almost straight ahead.
Dead ahead.
You mean that you were aiming straight above the top of the propeller?
Yes, this gun on the top of the wing just cleared the tip of your propeller so that you really aim the aircraft at the enemy instead of trying to aim the gun, because the gun was sighted in such a position in such a way that it synchronized with the center of the aircraft.
How often did you meet enemy aircraft?
Well, I met enemy aircraft on several occasions, but we didn't always get in contact with them, because their pilots at one time, they were equally as badly trained as ours was, and they had just as little experience. And if you came across one that was a bit nervous, well, he didn't come too close, or if you were too nervous, you didn't go too close to him. But you could usually tell how he was acting, if he were a good pilot or not. Then there was another thing you had to look out for, and that was that he wasn't a good pilot trying to encourage you too far over the lines. Because if he got you about, encouraged you to go over about 30 miles over the lines and you were alone, well then he could bring plenty of aircraft off to cut your retreat off when you want to come back. Altogether, I came in contact with, actual contact with about five enemy aircraft from time to time.
When you say contact, you actually mean you were involved in an aerial combat and you fired at each other?
Yes.
Now, during the course of these five operations, these five dogfights, did you call them dogfights?
We called them dogfights then, yes.
Did you actually hit each other? Bring any?
Well, I don't know about hitting him, but we came home on each occasion with two or three bullet marks in the fuselage and in the wings. Of course, they were easily patched up unless the bullet happened to touch a spar. And then, of course, in that case, we had to strip the whole wing and fit a new spar.
Were any of these fire scraps memorable for any reason?
No, they seemed just the ordinary run-of-the-mill scraps. You just recall them engagement. In your report, you simply say, I met an aircraft over so-and-so, and after firing so many rounds of ammunition, it broke off.
Now, we've talked about the various aspects of air gunnery at this time. Can we now switch to the other aspect of your work, the various kinds of observing which you were engaged in? Could you tell me what your observer duties were with Number 1 Squadron?
Well, there was artillery observation, in which Number 1 specialised, developed and specialised. Well, that was a definitely fixed job.
That was a regular routine.
Regular routine. Mm. But as regards the general observation, you just went up and you patrolled your part you were told to patrol. You kept your eyes open for any gun flashes, which would tell you where a gun emplacement was, a battery was placed. And if you saw any movements of troops, you made a note of that, what direction they were going on, an estimated number, and any supplies going up. Well, that was the type of observation we did, because everything in those days was more of a hit-or-miss business. We were still in its infancy as regard observation.
Could you describe for me, Mr. Saunders, the system of artillery observation which you employed with Number 1 Squadron?
Well, the day before the bombardment, we went up, that is, the air crew are going to operate with this particular battery, went up and we got in touch with the battery commander and we had a chat as to how the thing would proceed. And the time and everything, fixed up everything. We both had the target off the map reading, but that was all we had to go on. Well, we also brought up with a wireless operator, who, with his equipment, which consisted of a copper mat about 15 feet by 2 feet wide, and his aerial. And on our aircraft, we had an aerial, piece of copper wire of a given length, with the weight on the end of it, wound round a drum. And when we wanted to call the battery, we dropped this down, that hung down from the aircraft, and then with the aid of a Morse signal, we were able to contact the battery. And if the battery had heard us distinctly, they put out a white ground sheet just to show us that they had accepted us properly.
Now, this test to make sure that the Morse key was working and that the battery was receiving you. This test also took place on the day before the bombardment.
Yes, we tried it out the day before the bombardment, and then when we did go up to do the bombardment, we tested out again to make sure everything was okay. On the day of the bombardment, at the time arranged, we take off from the airfield and go over and run over the battery again and just send down the battery call. And if the operator got it all right, the wireless operator, he'd simply put out a piece of white sheeting. And then when we acknowledged it, he'd take it in. Then we went over the target. Well, the battery commander had the target from his map, and of course we had it. And we worked on the clock code.
Can I ask you what the purpose of the clock code was?
Well, the clock code was so that we could tell the battery commander how far his shots fell away or near the the target, being the centre of the clock, and then we used the clock figures to give him what direction he was in. Around this clock, on this clock code, we also had imaginary circles drawn from the centre at different distances. And these we knew as Ak, B, C, and Don. Ak is the signal, Ak was the signal for the battery to get ready to fire immediately we told him. And GG was the signal for him to fire, so that he fired that one gun. Well, we arranged it in such a way that when we were coming towards the gun, flying towards the gun, we gave the Ak-Ak signal. Then we maneuvered in such a position that we were near enough to the target to see where the shot fell when the shot arrived there, when the shell arrived there. And then we came back. On our way back, we told the battery commander where it was, whether it was 250 yards by saying B3, that'd be 50 yards to the right.